All right, good morning. How we doing? Got a couple claps. Is this my bad side or something? What's going on? It's kind of weird. Well, hey, I've missed a lot of you guys. It has been a crazy month for FSM. We talked about Barnabas. We got back from Barnabas. And then literally a week and 2 days later, we went and suffered for the gospel in Miramar Beach, Florida. Went to the beach. Had a good time there, and I'll tell you, the beach is the thing that stirs my affections most for the Lord. If you would say, Ben, you got to choose a place where you can find peace, where you can find relaxation, where you can find fun, the place you need to go, I will always choose the beach. There's something about the sound of the waves and the wind and the seagulls and the sand, and oh man, it is just stirs my affections. I love it. And so if you don't know, when you go to the beach, you have to be cognizant or aware of a few things. The first thing you have to be aware of, really the main thing you have to be aware of, are the flags that are on the lifeguard stands when you get there. Because that tells you a lot of different things. It communicates a lot of different things. And so when we were there, there were two flags up. There was one flag that was yellow, which means that the current is a moderate current. It's nothing crazy. It's nothing that's going to take you out to the ocean. But if you're not an experienced swimmer, then you should probably not be out there by yourself for too long. Then there was another flag underneath the yellow flag that was a purple flag. Now, a purple flag is not something you usually see at the beach, but it was there every single day we were there, and that just means dangerous marine life. 90% of the times, that means jellyfish. So the first day we were there, we saw the purple flag. I didn't see any jellyfish but the one that stung me on my hand, but these aren't the jellyfish that like have these tentacles like this. They have like these tiny, cute little tentacles, and so when they sting you, it burns for like 2 minutes, and you're like, I'm fine. But for me, I like cried about it for 5 minutes because I'm dramatic. Second day comes around, and we start to see a little bit more. We see, okay, there's one over here. Then about 20 minutes later, okay, there's one over here. And then a few minutes later, there's one over there. Like, they started to pop up a lot more. Then the last full day we were there, it was a little cloudy. The current was a lot more. And, I mean, they felt like they were everywhere. I mean, we were looking. They were washing up dead on shore. But, you know, we're not too afraid because we decided to grab the jellyfish and then lick it to see who's can do that. And did I participate? Of course I did. And so it felt like in that moment, there was a lot of jellyfish. And so while we were there, there was also a lot of algae, or what our students called alligajay. And so there was so much alligajay that you would get your hands and you'd kind of come up. And I mean, it would be everywhere on you. It was a lot of alligajay. And so we, every single day, we try to find the sandbar. And so me and two guys decided on the last day, let's get our boogie boards and let's go find this sandbar. And so we go out there, and it gets to the point when we're trying to go to the sandbar where the alligajay completely goes away. And it's clear as glass. From the top, you can see the bottom. And so, I mean, I love the ocean. I love all the marine life. And so we brought some snorkeling goggles with us. And I said, let me see what kind of sea life is underneath here. Well, I was not prepared for what I was about to see next. I put my goggles on and I look under. And I know I said I'm dramatic, and I'm very dramatic, and I'll be the first one to admit that. But when I say this, I am not being dramatic when I say, when I looked under from where we were at, there were thousands of jellyfish. And they weren't these dead, cute little ones. There were some that were like this big. And when I'm looking, there's like 15 or 20 that are around me and the two guys that we're with. And on the outside, I go, hey, guys, we should like probably go in because like it's not worth it. But on the inside, I'm like, every man for himself. Go, 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 go. I was about to leave them and like lose my job because I'm like, I'm not going to get stung by a jellyfish. They're dead. They're gone. Sorry, parents. I didn't want to get stung myself. We ended up getting back, and there were still people that didn't go out to the sandbar with us who there'd be a wave, and there were four or five jellyfish. They're like, ah, and we're like, that's nothing. You should see what's out there, because we had a moment where our perspective got to shift, where we went from that's a lot of jellyfish to no, that's a lot of jellyfish out there. So when we came back, that was really nothing for us. And so we are in the Old Testament. We are going through the 10 periods of the Old Testament every single week, and there is a common theme that we see in all of these stories. And it's the fact that God is not a one-dimensional God, that God always has a multi-layered, multi-faceted plan that we just can't understand. And for every one of us, the future is always gonna be the future until one day it becomes the present. And so there's a lot of things in that multi-layered plan of God that don't make any sense to us because we're on the shallow end with all the allegajay. But in that moment, it's confusing. And it's painful because it goes against what we believe the plan is supposed to be. And so we're gonna be diving into the Exodus and we're gonna be seeing this multi-leveled, multi-faceted plan of God through Moses and the Israelites. But before we do that, you know it's coming. We have to review, but instead of you guys just getting tired of me, Doug, and Tyler doing it, we have some interns that are coming on. So if you're my interns, come on up. We have 7 high school interns this summer with Fellowship Student Ministries, and we have 1 college intern, and we are going through just come right up here. Yeah, right center stage so your families can see your faces. So these are some of them, and so they're going through the same material, but instead of 30-minute sermon, they're going through 4 hours of material every single Monday morning, and they're gonna lead us through the motions. So stand up while the interns lead us through it. Let's give them a hand. Good job, guys. There's a thing we have with the internship, a saying, and it's always be prepared to preach, pray, or die. And I texted them on Thursday, I said, time to preach, you're coming on stage on Sunday. And they didn't even say anything. They were excited about it. So super excited about that internship. But those are the periods. And so as you can see, we've done creation, we've done patriarchs. We're now talking about the Exodus. But what we need to do first is we need to do a little bit of a catch up from where we've been. So as we know, we did the patriarchs last time, and we started with Abraham. Doug talked about the fact that God came to Abram, what was his name at the time, and he said, you're gonna be the father of a great nation, and I'm gonna promise you 3 things: land, seed, and blessing. And through those things, you're gonna be a people, and through your offspring, singular, which I think is really awesome, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And so Abraham has a son, his name is Isaac. Isaac has a son, his name is Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons, which if you don't know, the 12 tribes of Israel were based off of the 12 sons of Jacob. And we zoom in Genesis 37 through 50 on a man named Joseph, which knowing the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1, it seems a little random because the line of Jesus doesn't continue on through Joseph. The line of Jesus continues on with Judah. So the question is, why did we spend 13 chapters talking about this man, Joseph? Because at the end of the day, the Old Testament, all it is, it's a story of God's people. That's all the Old Testament is. From Genesis 12 all the way to the end of Malachi, it is the story of God's people. And the reason we focus so heavily on Joseph is because that just explains how the people got to Egypt. Because as we know, there's a famine that happens. Joseph becomes second in command, and he saves them from a famine and gets his 70 family members who are living in the promised land that was promised to Abraham, and moves them over to Egypt. And so that story gets us into the beginning of Exodus, where it starts like this in Exodus chapter 1. Then Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service and mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So the beginning of Exodus 1, we see that they're multiplying greatly. They started with 70 people moving over to Exodus at the end of the book of Genesis. And now all of a sudden, there's a large people, which is showing the fulfillment of the promise of God that the seed is going to be great. He told Abraham to look at the stars. You're not going to be able to number them. That's going to be your people. That's how many people you're going to have. So we see it growing, but then we see a little bit of a kink in the plan. Now all of a sudden they're enslaved. And so Exodus, we begin to see a man be introduced onto the scene, and his name is Moses. And he is introduced not only in a very bleak time because the people of Israel are enslaved, but it's very bleak because during the time that Moses is born, there's a decree that goes out to say everyone who is a Hebrew male has to be killed and thrown into the Nile River. So Moses gets born during that time. His family hides him, gets to the point where they can't hide him anymore. They put him in a basket in the Nile, and his mom basically says, "He's all yours now, Lord." And we know the story that Pharaoh's daughter is out bathing one day. She finds Moses in this basket. She takes Moses and raises him as her own. And so Moses is raised as an Egyptian. He's raised in the palace. He's raised with an Egyptian education. He's raised learning the Egyptian language. But there's one thing you can't change about someone, and that's the way that they look. So no matter what Moses gets taught, there's this feeling of like, I don't belong here, I belong out there, but the people that I belong with are being enslaved. There comes a time where an Egyptian taskmaster is beating up on a Hebrew. Moses thinks no one's looking and murders that Hebrew, or that Egyptian, thinks nobody sees. The next day, there's two Hebrew people that are out arguing, and Moses tries to break it up, and they say, "What are you gonna do, kill us like you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" Uh-oh, everyone knows. And Moses, out of fear, didn't just flee the palace in Egypt. He fled Egypt altogether. He went to the land of Midian, where that is where we are introduced to Moses as someone who lived in fear, who was dictated by fear. And he just wasn't in the land of Midian for a couple of days and then decided to go back. He was in the land of Midian for 40 years. Which I feel like 40 years isn't like a short amount of time. 40 years is the amount of time where you're like, I'm not going back to Egypt. I've left that in my past. It's in my rearview mirror, and then I rip the rearview mirror out because I'm not looking back. I don't want to deal with it anymore. I don't want to talk about it. I'm going to act like that never even happened. And that's the person we're introduced here in the beginning of Exodus. And this week, I got to see this story in a brand new light. Because I think we look at the book of Exodus and all of us know what happens in Exodus. I think what I'm about to share isn't going to be this like spoiler. We know that Moses gets raised up to set the people of Israel free. And we always think that. I've always thought that. The book of Exodus is about how God radically pursued the people of Israel and set them free from bondage. But what I realized for the first time this week that I've never been able to see is not only did God radically pursue the Israelite people, but the God of the universe also radically pursued the person of Moses too. And so we see that in the midst of this big, grand story that God is writing in the world and in Israel, it doesn't change the significance of the story God is writing in Moses' life. Moses had run. The world had forgotten about Moses, but can I say something? The God of the universe never did. I think we look in the Old Testament and we see this big God involved in big things with big people. And I think we fail to realize the personal nature of God, even in the Old Testament. I think we view God a lot of times as this person. I need to do this for God. God wants me to do this for him. He wants to radically pursue his people through me. But we fail to realize that in the moments that God is pursuing other people through us, he's also radically pursuing us as well. Because the plan of God from the very beginning of time is he sets people free, and then he uses the set free to set other people free. Then he uses those set free to set other people free, and so on and so forth. It's not just this one-dimensional plan of God, and we start to see that unravel a little bit. We start to see that it's not just God redeeming Israel, it's also God radically redeeming Moses as well. So we see the pursuit of God. And so God comes to Moses in Exodus chapter 3 through a burning bush, which not something that happens, I'm guessing, all the time. Moses goes down and he says, "Here I am, Lord." And at that point, Moses is probably like, "I'm about to do anything this bush tells me to do," because bushes usually don't talk. And God says, "Hey, I've heard the affliction of my people. I want you to go back to Egypt." And you could see, imagine being Moses for a second. Remember, that's his past. He's like, "That was in my rearview mirror and I ripped the rearview mirror off. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to be about it." And when God tells Moses to go back to Egypt to tell Pharaoh, who's not only this powerful person, he is the most powerful person in the most powerful nature, in the most powerful nation, which makes him the most powerful person on earth. And God wants him to go back not only to his past where all this pain and shame and guilt and hurt await him. He wants him to go to the most powerful person on earth and say, "Hey, you know those people who are giving you free labor? You should let them go." And so Moses continues to give him excuses. But God, "I'm not eloquent. But God, who am I? But God, who are you? God, I think you got the wrong guy." And continually we see God pursue his heart, but it's really interesting the way God did. So think about this for a second with me. If somebody is talking to you and they're kind of talking bad about themselves, "Oh, I just don't think I'm very good looking. I'm not smart. I'm not intelligent. No one likes me." Someone tells that to you, what are you going to say back to them? "No, like, look at you. Like, you look good today. No, you're smart. This is why you're smart. And this is why you're smart." And we hype this person up. We try to build up their ego a little bit. Like, "You're good looking. You're really smart." Like, we try to build them up. God never did that with Moses when Moses was talking bad about himself. He doesn't hype him up at all. He doesn't go, "Moses, my dude, my guy. Hey, dude, like, I chose you because look at your education. You think those slaves have an education like you have? Not only do you have a great education that the other Israelites don't have, you speak the language, and you grew up in the same household that the king of Egypt is now reigning over. Like, you are the person. I chose you for a reason." God never does that one time. God says, "But Moses, I will be with you. But Moses, I will give you the words." And I love that. And that just shows continually that pursuit of God in Moses' life, because God doesn't focus on him, on Moses. God focuses on himself. God says, "Moses, you're not going to do this by yourself. I'm not asking you to go by yourself. I'm not just throwing you in the deep end and saying, 'I hope you can figure out how to swim, bud.' I'm throwing you into the deep end and I'm jumping in with you." Because Moses, at the end of the day, the only way that you're going to find healing from your past is if you do it with me. And in that moment this week, as I'm learning that, like, man, like, this God that we view as angry and this big, not personal God, I got to view him this week as this personal, tender God towards Moses, who cared deeply for him. And so we start to see this multifaceted plan of God really unfolding. And then, you know, we think about Moses. So I've always thought about Moses as this guy who's big and tough and gruff and not afraid of anything. But also, Moses is in the New Testament in Hebrews chapter 11 in what is called the Hall of Faith. That dude's got the biggest paragraph, two paragraphs devoted only to him. "By faith, Moses, by faith, Moses, by faith, Moses, by faith, Moses." But for some reason, when Moses is introduced, we really feel like with all this is being said that he fled out of fear. He didn't want to go. He really went to Egypt kicking and screaming. We start thinking to ourselves, is Moses really faithful? How in the world could this man be not only in the Hall of Faith, but have the largest section in the Hall of Faith? And I think that reason isn't because God made a mistake by putting him in the Hall of Faith, but I think that reason is because we just have a really bad definition of what faith really is. Because faith isn't the absence of doubt and fear. Faith is not the absence of doubt and fear. In fact, faith doesn't always mean 100% belief either. It doesn't mean no doubt, no hesitation, and jumping in with absolutely no fear. You know, there may be some things that God asks us to do, and we're like, boom, easy. We don't think about it, we just do it because we know that God's got it. But honestly, in my life, I cannot think of a single thing that God has ever asked me to do where that has been the case. I feel like 99.999 repeating percent of the things that God asks us to do, there's fear, there's hesitation, there's frustration, and a lot of us probably have the exact same feeling and excuses that Moses has. Like, I don't want to, God, what if this, what if that? I mean, I play the what if game with God all of the time. And can I say something about that for a second? That's completely okay. Because faith doesn't mean 100% belief. Faith means I'm gonna persevere despite the doubt. I'm gonna be obedient despite the fear. Because I have just enough belief to outweigh my unbelief. And I think of this story in the New Testament, one of my favorite stories in the New Testament, when there's a storm and the disciples are out on the Sea of Galilee and they're freaking out, which when fishermen freak out in a storm, that's when you're like, I think I should probably freak out too. And they see, you know, this person, they think it's a ghost, and it was just Jesus doing apparently his evening stroll on the Sea of Galilee. And he goes, guys, I'm not a ghost. It's me, Jesus. And so then homeboy Peter, which is the exception of every rule ever in the history of the planet, Peter goes, tries to find out if Jesus really is Jesus, which most people would be like, oh yeah, when's my birthday? What birthmark do I have on my left arm? No, Peter goes, if it's you, Jesus, tell me to come out here and walk on water with you. And I could see the disciples being like, what? Out of all the things you could choose, you chose that one. All right, Peter, go figure that one out. And Jesus says, all right, come on. Like, come walk with me, Peter. And remember, before that, all of the disciples were in terrible fear for their lives. And Peter steps out of the boat. It says that he walks on water. And then he looks around and he takes his eyes off Jesus. He sees the waves. He gets afraid and he sinks. But I don't think that doubt and fear came from nowhere. I think when Jesus is like, all right, Peter, come on out, I don't think Peter was like 100% believing. I think there was a lot of doubt in Peter. You know, he's looking around, but he had just enough belief to outweigh his unbelief in that moment. And it was when his unbelief outweighed his belief that he sank. Because faith isn't the absence of doubt and fear. It's the perseverance and being obedient despite all of those things. You know, and I think even a modern day example of that, I have a buddy who's in the Middle East right now, and he is in a country that if they found out what he was doing, like, he would for sure be killed in a second. They would just shoot him on the spot. And I love hearing him tell his story about how he got to that country. You know, for a year, God was pressing in on him. Hey, you should go to this country. He was like, nope. Hey, you should go to this country. Not for me. Hey, you should go to this country. And God kept pressing in on him. And he wasn't only like, well, God, he was like, absolutely not. Like, thanks God for asking. I know you're not asking, but I'm not doing it. I don't want to do it. And then God finally got his attention, and he describes it as going to this country kicking and screaming. But he said something that I'll never forget. He actually uses this example with Peter walking on water. He said, you know what, Ben? I'm the biggest crybaby missionary in the history of the planet. But he said, but guess what? I would rather be a crybaby missionary that walks on water and sinks because I walked on water than to be the other 11 disciples who stayed in the boat and never got out. So God finally gets Moses' attention, and Moses isn't happy about it. Moses is probably terrified. He's probably going kicking and screaming, but he goes nonetheless, which I would venture to say takes a heck of a lot of faith to do. So Moses gets there, he goes to Pharaoh, he says, Pharaoh, let my people go. And Pharaoh went, ah, I knew this day was coming. Like, I knew I couldn't get free labor forever. We've had it for the last 400 years, but okay, your people can go free. Just like, tell them I'm sorry for like treating them badly for the last 400 years. Do you think that happened? Did not happen. This is what happened instead. In Exodus chapter 5, after Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens." And Pharaoh said, "Behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens." The same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, "You shall no longer give people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past, you shall impose on them and shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore, they cry, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let heavier work be laid on the men that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words." Not only did Moses go to Pharaoh and he said no, Moses went to Pharaoh and he made the Israelites' life a whole lot harder, which in that moment had to make Moses go, "What the heck, man? I was faithful. It took a lot to get here. You had to give me like a pump-up speech, and I got here, and then look at what you did. You've made their lives a whole lot harder," because in so many times in life, God can be painfully slow. So many times in life, God gives us a promise and we say, "Awesome, that's the promise of God." And then we wait and we wait and we wait. Abraham, perfect example of that. God gave him the promise and said, "Through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed." And he says, "I don't have a kid." He says, "But you will have a kid." He was 75 years old when God gave him that promise. Do you know how old he was when Isaac was born? 100 years old. God told him he would have a son, and 25 years later, that promise happened. But let me tell you something. Faithfulness, despite no results over time, deepens our faith and moves us from fleeting feelings to an unwavering, objectified reality. I'm going to say that one more time. Faithfulness, despite no results over time, deepens our faith and moves us from fleeting feelings to an unwavering, objectified reality. And honestly, what it does is it allows us to wrestle with God. There is something so beautiful about following Jesus compared to every other religion. Every other religion is submission without questioning. You will submit, this is the way it is, and don't ask any questions. But our faith is based off of man Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, who means one who wrestles with God. Jacob was in a really hard time in his life. He was questioning the goodness of God a lot. And it says that a man came down and wrestled with him the entirety of the night. Jacob ended up getting this man in a headlock and said, "I will not let you go until you bless me." And this man that he had in a headlock ended up touching his hip, like, and put it out of place, which you're like, where was that power of the whole night that you were wrestling with him? And he says, "You will no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, because you have wrestled with God." The God of the universe came down and wrestled with Jacob, and he allowed Jacob to wrestle with him. Because listen to this, in the moments that we're wrestling with God, in the moments that we're like, "God, where the heck are you? God, what is going on?" There's something so intimate about wrestling. Because you're touching, you're sweating, and in that moment, Jacob is frustrated with God, but God is allowing him to be frustrated with him because he's like, "I just want to be with you." Because through the painfully slow times, we can realize that God is near even in those times. But we know that through this story and through our own stories that yes, God is painfully slow, but he is always on time. God is painfully slow, but he is always on time, because God has a perspective that we will never have. Because in this moment, Moses is in the shallow end with all the alligajay. And he can't see, and he's confused, and he says, "But God, I thought your plan was to set us free." And obviously, that didn't happen the first time, but we see that God has a multi-layered, multi-faceted plan that we're not able to see, because God's plan wasn't only to set the people of Israel free from their captors. God's plan also was to show the Egyptians his power as well. Because we know that Pharaoh said no. And then we know from the children's stories that God ended up sending 10 plagues to Egypt, which I think it's funny that those are children's stories. And then God gave the Egyptians horrible boils, and they would rather die than go through another day with the boils. Good night, sunshine. Don't let the boils get you. I'm just kidding. Or am I? It's weird that don't read your children Old Testament stories before bed. But we know that these plagues happen. And can I tell you something that's really amazing about the plan of God, the multidimensional, multi-layered plan of God? Is that God sent 10 plagues not because he just like randomly did it, because God has never done anything randomly one time ever. He hasn't even accidentally done something random. In fact, every single plague that God put against Egypt attacked either one or many of their gods. If you remember in Exodus chapter 5, when Moses went to Pharaoh and said, God says, my God says to let my people go. Pharaoh says, I know my gods. I don't know yours. And it's almost like God went, you don't know who I am? Boy, you about to. And so we see 9 of these plagues happen. God turns water into blood. He brings frogs. He brings gnats. He brings flies. The cattle die. People get boils. Hail comes destroying their crop. The locust comes and destroys the rest. Darkness happens for 3 whole days. And every single time these plagues happen, Pharaoh's heart continues to be hardened. He says, no, your people will not go. Until finally the 10th and final plague comes, which happens in Exodus chapter 12. And he says, then Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and select lambs for yourselves according to your clans and kill the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood that is in the basin and touch the lintel and the 2 doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. None of you shall go out of the door of his house until the morning, for the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the 2 doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you. You shall observe this rite as a statute for you and for your sons forever. And when you come into the land that the Lord will give you and he has promised, you shall keep this service. And when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? You shall say, it is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians, but spared our houses. But the people bowed their heads and worshiped. Then the people of Israel went and did so as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. So they did. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, and all his servants and all the Egyptians. And there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. Then he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, up. Go from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also. So God is not only wanting to redeem his people from slavery, he's also wanting to show the power of himself by attacking the Egyptian gods. A theologian by the last name of Davis, he says this, the death cry which was heard throughout Egypt was not only a wail that bemoaned the loss of a son or precious animals, but also the incapability of the many gods of Egypt to respond and protect them from such tragedy. God's on a mission. God, I feel like there's another big theme in the Old Testament. Just as God got Moses' attention, he also got Pharaoh's. We're also seeing this multi-level, multi-layered plan of God in that he wasn't just pursuing Israel, he was also pursuing Moses. He wasn't just wanting to redeem the Israelites from slavery, he was also wanting to show his power to the Egyptians as well. But also through this Passover, we get to see a whole nother multi-level plan of God. And it's not just something that spans a couple of days, a couple of weeks, it's something that spans a couple of millennia. Because after this, the Israelites get set free and they end up practicing every single year this Passover meal. And it's very ritualistic. And they go through this meal as a remembrance of what God did, is that God passed over their people by killing the lamb and not killing their firstborn. And we see that the Israelites were absolutely no different than the Egyptians. Just because they were God's people doesn't mean that God would just have mercy on them because they were his people. We also see God saying, unless you are covered by the blood of the lamb, then you are not innocent. In the Passover, we don't just see this in the Old Testament. We also see the Passover in the New Testament. And it's really interesting, and I can't wait to show you guys. In Matthew chapter 26, Jesus is eating the Passover meal with his disciples. And it says, now on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover? He said, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he reclined at the table with the 12. Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Now, I would venture to say that's not the first time that we've read that or heard that as a church. But I will say, for us, it's just like, no, Jesus took bread and said, take, eat, this is my body. But I will say that if you are a Jew reading this for the first time, or if you're a disciple that's reclining at Jesus' table, what Jesus just said is incredibly shocking. Let me explain why. This Passover meal is incredibly ritualistic. They do the same thing over and over and over again. They wear the same thing. They prepare the meal the same way. They wear the same things. And you see, the part of the ritualistic thing of the Passover is that they would grab the bread and they would break the bread and they would say, this is the bread of affliction which our fathers ate in Egypt. Jesus took the bread, and he didn't stick to that ritual of saying it, because guess what? We're no longer celebrating the bread of affliction that was put on the Passover lamb, but now there is a new covenant that is happening, and he says that we're no longer celebrating the Passover lamb. We're now celebrating me, who's about to take the affliction of not just the firstborn 1,500 years ago, but for everyone who deserves death because of sin. Jesus is changing things up. So we no longer have to remember the Passover lamb, because the person who that Passover lamb was pointing to was sitting in the room right in front of them. And so what this does is this just shows the significance of what John the Baptist said when he first saw Jesus, when Jesus first started his ministry, behold the Lamb of God who has come to take the sin of the world. Y'all, we cannot even begin to know our New Testament unless we know our Old Testament, because everything that Jesus did and is going to do is a fulfillment of everything that was talked about in the Old Testament. Jesus is a fulfillment of the Passover lamb. Jesus was never an afterthought of God. Like, oh, like Adam and Eve messed up. Didn't see that one coming. We got to find something else to do. All right, I'll do a flood, and then that'll solve it. Oh, they messed it up again. Oh, plan C, Abraham. Oh, you messed up too. What is happening? Moses, oh, you messed up too. There was never an afterthought of God. God's plan A has always been from the very beginning was Jesus. It always has been Jesus, and it always will be Jesus. Everything in the Old Testament doesn't just talk about Jesus. Jesus fulfills everything in the Old Testament. The most Jewish thing to do is to take communion together. That's what we now do. Communion is a branch off of the Passover meal, because they would take the bread and say, this is the bread of affliction. And then they would take one of the four cups that they would drink, and they say, this symbolizes the blood of the lamb that was slain 1,500 years ago. But now we take that cup and we say, this is the blood of Jesus that was spilled for the forgiveness of our sins. Y'all, the most Jewish thing to do is to take communion. because the Messiah was, the Old Testament Messiah, people thought he would be this reigning king, but not only will the Messiah be a reigning king, he will become the reigning king first by becoming the perfect Passover lamb. And so this is what we're gonna do. Ushers, if you wanna come forward, I think the perfect thing for us to do this morning is to pass the elements together. We're just gonna celebrate what God has done. And so we're gonna be passing these elements, and then when we get them, we will read through and just think about the fact that as we're taking these elements, this isn't a brand new thing. This is something that has been prophesied for 1,500 years before Jesus even came.